You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
A cavalcade of continental spy scandals, American campus protests evolve from protests to arguments about the propriety of protesting, and Australia drops dramatically down Elon Musk's list of holiday destinations. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Melissa Fung and Nick Gowing will discuss the day's big stories. And in the latest of our reports from MIPIM, we'll ponder the future trajectory of the global property market. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Melissa Fung, journalist, filmmaker, and author of Between Good and Evil, The Stolen Girls of Boko Haram, and by Nick Gowing, former Channel 4 and BBC reporter and a distinguished fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Hello to you both.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Andrew.
Melissa, first of all, you are recently returned from Washington, D.C., and in telling us about that, you can also insert a further seamless plug for your book.
You already did. Thank you very much. Yes, it was the 10th anniversary of the Chibok kidnappings in Nigeria last Sunday, and so I had a little book event to mark that sad anniversary at a beautiful bookstore called Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. And so the book came out in paperback as well last week, and so it's available everywhere now.
Because 10 years on, the book is still actually depressingly timely, isn't it? The phenomenon of kidnappings in Nigeria has not dwindled.
In fact, I think it's getting worse in some cases. You know, we just saw last month two mass kidnappings, more than 200 students in two different provinces. Now, most of those students have been returned now and rescued. But you know, mostly gangs now, not just Boko Haram, are realizing that kidnapping for ransom is very lucrative.
And Nick, no need for me at least to ask you where you have recently been. I know because I was there as well at the Delphi Economic Forum. Aside from the excellent dinner they served us up by way of welcome, how was the event for you?
Really very good. This is the Delphi Economic Forum, a remarkable place, of course. Delphi goes back into the annals of Greek history. It's a most incredible place. We weren't sitting among the monuments. We weren't sitting among the excavations. But it was very intense. And I go to a lot of conferences, mainly to meet people, dare I say, like you, over dinner. Otherwise, we wouldn't be... I think you'd invited me on anyway before we met at dinner. But it's actually the people you bump into and the cards you come away with and the insights you get, not necessarily from the platform. I interviewed Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, not necessarily from the platform, but actually over the coffees.
And Delphi is really good like that because everyone's stuck up a hill in the middle of nowhere, so they can't run away from you.
Well, it's not quite the middle of nowhere. It's stuck up a hill. But it is the most glorious location. It is inspiring. I've been there, I think, four times, and it may sound like one's having a good time. Actually, these are very hard work. And I say that not to feel sorry for myself. But being a conference geek is actually an art in itself, to know who to meet, how to meet them, and how to build relationships with them. So you can email them. You can pick up the phone and you can get them and maybe they'll say something to you which they weren't going to say otherwise.
Well, we will start tonight's show proper in Germany, where police and intelligence services have been rounding up a number of alleged cloak and dagger merchants from China and Russia. Most sensationally, one of those lifted, identified thus far as Jan G, is an assistant to Maximilian Krah, MEP, who sits in the European Parliament representing unsavoury far-right Fulminator's Alternative for Deutschland. This roughly accompanies the arrest of three other Germans also accused of spying for China and follows the arrest of two German-Russian dual nationals accused of planning sabotage attacks against Germany directed from Moscow. As is traditional, Russia and China deny everything. Nick, first of all, it would kind of be more surprising if this wasn't happening, wouldn't it?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I've spent much of my career in Eastern Europe and some of it in China as well. And so none of this is a surprise. These countries are very strategic in the way they find people, plant people, agents of influence and so on. And it's not just, of course, China and Russia. The Americans, CIA, and the British, MI6, they do exactly the same thing. A very senior MI6 officer, I heard him say, our job is one thing. It's to steal secrets. And one of the ways in which we knew a lot about, or the Secret Services knew a lot about what was going to happen in Ukraine when Bill Burns, the CIA director, went there in November 2021 to finger what was going on and tell Putin, we know what you're up to, is because of the agents inside Russian military and also the security services. Many of them will have been withdrawn by now or got out of the country. But so it's a part of life. Frankly, I've been around a long time. I'm not surprised at all.
Melissa, should we be shocked at all related to this, that they appear to be targeting populist parties as ripe for recruitment, perhaps sensing that quite a few of the people involved in these parties might be of debatable loyalty and perhaps somewhat lacking in intellectual apparatus?
That's a diplomatic way of putting it. But I don't think that they are just targeting these people to sort of the populist right, so to speak, because, you know, in Canada, there are lots of allegations that this kind of interference is happening within the Liberal Party, that they have somehow infiltrated the governing party and interfered in the last two elections. There's a inquiry going on in Ottawa right now about this very topic. And, you know, all sorts of allegations, a busload full of Chinese high school students coerced into voting for a Liberal candidate, right? There was a talk of an opaque sort of injection of thousands of dollars towards a campaign. All these allegations are now being aired at this inquiry, this commission in Ottawa. And, you know, it's just really not surprising if you're familiar with the work of the United Front Work Department, which is an arm of the CCP in China. And this is what they do. They have, you know, we've talked about police stations or so-called police stations that they have, maybe over 100 of them all around the world, keeping tabs on the diaspora in other countries and making sure that they are, you know, towing the party line, so to speak. So as Nick said, none of this should be surprising to us.
Nick, you mentioned that the MI6 officer saying that the job of his organization was to steal secrets.
His words, I have to say.
But is that necessarily all that's going on here? Is it not also the case that, and it probably has always been the case, but when we think about China and Russia and their activities in the democratic West in recent years, it's also to stir up trouble and cause chaos and confusion, isn't it?
It's really to influence. And it's not just about undercover stuff. Look at what Russia Today, RT, is doing very successfully, I have to say. Look at what they're doing with... This has been going on with the KGB and the FSB for decades, and that's been part of their spycraft. But what they're doing is they're extending it now. They will have recruited vast numbers of people who they will then activate. And it's not just about old people who are disaffected and maybe broken marriages and want a bit of cash. It's also the next generation as well. And we've got to be careful because there's a case which is going to be in court on Friday here in the United Kingdom. And so we can't talk in any detail. And the Crown Prosecution Service have warned about that. But there are people of in the early 20s who are fingered and go to universities and they are picked up and they are worked on, just as the security services here will go to the main universities and see who might be a good agent in future. And when you look at the advertisements which have been in places like The Economist for security service personnel, they're looking for very different kind of people. People you would never suspect are actually agents. And that's what the Russians and Chinese are doing. But I have to say the CIA and the MI6 and others are equally successful.
Melissa, does it strike you, though, that in terms of the stirring up trouble aspect of it, China and Russia are trying to accomplish similar things? I'm put in mind of a conversation I had several years ago with a former very senior American intelligence officer who boiled it down. I mean, it was fantastically quotably glib, but he said the difference is that the Russians want to destroy us, the Chinese just want to own us.
I think that's pretty accurate. You know, just look at how hard it's been in Congress in Washington to pass aid to Ukraine, right? Because somehow, you know, there are several low-ranking Republicans who, I will just say they're MAGA, have been holding up this process for a very long time. And now that it's finally gotten through, now they're threatening to, you know, kick out the speaker because this they did not somehow want to aid Ukraine in their fight with Russia. And so I think, you know, yes, Russia and China are both interfering in the West for different reasons, but ultimately I think the goals, the end game might end up being the same.
Just a final quick thought on this one, Nick, and it goes back a bit to what we were discussing about that delineation between stealing secrets and stirring up trouble. Has the latter aspect of it become more important in a world in which secrets, one assumes, are vastly more available than they used to be? I mean, again, this was a different intelligence officer I was talking to years ago, former MI6, who said, you know, he could remember the Cold War and thinking that if, you know, for example, if you wanted to know the top speed of a particular Soviet-built armoured personnel carrier, that might take weeks of patient espionage to discover, whereas now any clown with a laptop can find it out in 2 seconds. Are there still as many secrets as there were waiting to be found?
It depends how you define a secret, of course, but it's also about understanding intent and what the intention is of people to doing their jobs and what kind of analysis is being fostered by those in positions of power and responsibility, and finding out what is being thought about in major companies and every government. I mean, China has been superbly active, supremely active as well, in the 54 states of Africa, trying to manipulate. Russia is incredibly active now in Russia, as it was in Syria and so on. So it's not just about Germany. It's not just about the UK. It's about everywhere. It's about having influence. And that means having influence and deciding and finding out what is going on. And you do that by talking to people or dropping or eavesdropping or building relationships with people, however you define that relationship.
Well, let's move along to the United States and the bar delineating the point at which anybody over the age of about 24 should care in the slightest what occurs on university campuses is a lofty one, but it has been at the very least neared by recent events at several American schools. Protests against Israel's war in Gaza and the United States' support of it have led to arrests at New York University and Yale and the cancellation of in-person classes at Columbia. Well, we're joined now from New York City by the journalist Karina Choi. Karina, first of all, what are things like where you are currently?
So we are now a week into the Columbia University-led pro-Palestinian encampment, and this has sparked a nationwide protest movement across college campuses, which has been largely peaceful but has led to, you know, more than 130 arrests in NYU in downtown Manhattan. And at Yale and New Haven, 50 students have been arrested. Many of them are now facing suspension. Columbia today also announced that it will give students the choice of attending classes in person or online until the end of term, which is less than a month's time. And overall, things have been, you know, peaceful in terms of what the protesters are doing on campus. They're staging demonstrations. They're nonviolent. There have been reports of some instances of anti-Semitism, but from what I've seen, those have been sort of provoked by pro-Palestinian demonstrators who are not actually students who have come onto campus or outside of Columbia's gates with sort of their own agenda, which has also caused some students to fear for their safety.
Karina, can you give us a sense of the scale of these things? How, in terms of the campus, how big a protest is it? Is this something that is involving a significant plurality of students?
I would say so. And, you know, I've seen some unofficial polling online which says that, you know, in terms of the makeup of the students protesting, a lot of them, it's a huge mix. And surprisingly, or maybe unsurprisingly, at these college campuses, a lot of Jewish students are showing up and joining, you know, pro-Palestinian demonstrators of all walks of life to sit in on campus. I would say the last time I went on campus, there were roughly, you know, a couple hundred of students sitting in. And, you know, as we, with the Jewish Passover holiday taking place this week, I've seen Jewish students lead a seder at Columbia's encampment with dozens of students of different backgrounds and faiths. Faculty members have also been involved in the movement as well. Yesterday at Columbia, they staged a walkout in support of students protesting peacefully.
And just finally, Karina, as a Columbia alumni yourself, is this characteristic of the university? Does it have a grand tradition of protests of this scale, or is this something new?
Columbia has had a long history of, you know, championing free speech on campus. The university, you know, promotes political debate and dissent. You know, as a reporter, I don't feel like it's right to share my political views, but I am a former student at Columbia, and I am concerned about how the university has called the police to arrest its own students, when, from what I've seen, they've been quite peaceful. And also, it's frustrating, as, you know, an alumna of the journalism school, to see that press are given limited access, if not no access to campus at all. And this has just given way to more inaccurate information spreading online and even reaching the White House.
Karina Choi, thank you very much for joining us. We'll bring the panel in now. Melissa, first of all, is this, and I'm trying to sound as unpatronizing here as I possibly can, but is this basically students doing as students should? This is part of the point of going to university, isn't it, to sort of figure out what you think about things?
I think that's true. I think, though, that this particular conflict, you know, has, just because it's gone on so long, has really inflamed passions on both sides. And so this is what students do. Don't forget, in 1968, students at Columbia were protesting as well. And unfortunately, the police were also called in then. So I think, you know, and I'm a as an alumni as well, I was quite dismayed to see that happen this time around, because I would have thought that, you know, the administration, the Columbia administration, would have just allowed students to do what they do, right? Mm. They are finding their voice. They are passionate about this war. And to call on the police, now I realize what Karina was saying, that maybe outside protesters had come and there were some anti-Semitic remarks being made. I wish that the administration had just allowed the students to have their camp, have their protest, and leave them alone. I mean, it is that area. That's the students' area where they have put their encampment. And so, you know, I think it was really unfortunate that they called on the police to remove them.
Nick, were you ever much of a barricade straddler yourself?
No, I wasn't. I tended to report it when I was a student, a journalist. But let me just add to what Melissa said and what we heard from the campus there, because Manoush Shafiq, who's the principal of Columbia, who used to be until a year ago the head of the London School of Economics here in the UK, she actually asked students to stay away from the campus, citing incidents, and this is the important bit, of intimidation and harassing behaviour, and tensions have been exploited and amplified by individuals who are not affiliated with Columbia, who have come to campus to pursue their own agendas. So I would suggest to you that it's far more complicated than just students getting angry and passionate. I have to say there was an air of Vietnam about this to me, but what we're now seeing, particularly with the Palestinians and particularly with the Jewish and the Israeli cause, is a deepening and a radicalizing on both sides. And I think, quite apart from students, it's going to become more sinister as the days go by. This is without resolution.
Melissa, does that radicalising get amplified, accelerated, catalysed, call it what you will, by attention being paid to it from social media, from outside media? If it was just a case of students having a demonstration and a conversation among themselves about this conflict, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a thing, would it?
I think the fuel is added when, you know, you have social media and students are filming the police coming and tearing down their tents, you know, and they put that on social media. And we have to remember that, you know, on a lot of social media, TikTok, there are snippets, right? And it could be very inflammatory if there is no context to it. And so I think that's been part of it. You know, these students that I'm going to date myself by saying that age group, these young people, are very savvy.
I think you're the youngest at this table by some distance, if that's any consolation.
Oh, but, you know, they are very savvy on social media in a way that, you know, you and I are not. And so I think that doesn't help add fuel to the fire.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned inflammatory and contextless social media, because to Australia, where Earth's richest and most annoying individual has gotten off fairly lightly by the standards of local prime ministerial knockabout. Those standards established by former PM Paul Keating, who addressed one opponent as a stupid, foul-mouthed grub who would be flat out counting past 10. Those were the days. The current incumbent, Anthony Albanese, has described Elon Musk merely as an arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law. After a row over the refusal of Twitter, the social media platform nobody but Elon Musk calls X, to remove footage of last week's stabbing of an Assyrian priest in Sydney. An Australian court ordered all such videos to be removed, and Australia's online safety regulator is seeking to enforce the ban globally. Twitter has duly censored the content in Australia, but Musk's contention is that what Twitter broadcasts elsewhere is none of Australia's concern. Nick, it's an incredibly irritating question to have to ask, never mind consider, but does Elon Musk kind of have a point?
Well, first of all, let me just say it's interesting listening to the rhetoric coming from the politicians and the political class in your country and the kind of language that they've used, which I think is quite extraordinary. I think that this is indicative of a problem that Musk is now facing. His share price is going down. He's just sacked 10% of his staff. He's cutting back production of his cars, and quite apart from what he's doing now to X or Twitter. So he's now going from the person who's going to make people rich because of the share options they've got to actually someone who's going to be a big problem. And it's made me think all along with Musk for the last 4 or 5 years, despite the brilliance of his EVs, where's he getting the cash from? He spent $44 billion on Twitter. Where did that cash really come from? I mean, is he really a shell company who's just living on borrowed time and no money?
Melissa, if we consider this question from the other perspective, though, should more national governments be this rigorous about enforcing what social media platforms carry onto their territory?
I don't know that they actually can, because anybody with a VPN can go on to Twitter and access that content that, you know, has been banned in Australia. If there's content that's been banned here, anybody with a VPN can access that. So I don't know that, you know, governments really are able to stop people from seeing things that they don't want to see on social media. I hate to say it, but maybe Musk has, I hate to give him a point, but, you know, maybe he has one here.
But to further this, Nick, and this is where I will give one of my own pet hobby horses a thrash. Twitter has taken this down in Australia. So has Meta, the parent company of Facebook et al. If they do remove this or indeed any other content, are they not implicitly acknowledging that we have editorial discretion? We can do this. We are therefore publishers, not actual neutral, entirely inanimate conduits of information as they prefer to portray themselves.
As someone who used to work in a newsroom at the BBC, where you have to be really conscious of what you're saying and how you're saying it, not control, but just in terms of taste, I do think that we've got to the stage where social media is having to control itself. And therefore, there is a movement, which is one of certainly eyes of a former working journalist, became increasingly irritated by the fact that we weren't quite sure what we were reading on a particular site or a particular posting was really accurate or not, or just a sounding off. And I think we are getting to that stage where there's got to be some kind of validation of what is being written.
Melissa, what do you think on the similar question, just before we move on? Should they be held as responsible as any legacy masthead is for what appears under their brand? The comparison I would make is if someone writes a letter to the editor of a newspaper which contains a libel and the newspaper prints it, the newspaper can get done for publishing it.
It will get done for publishing it. It
has happened. Therefore, should the social media platforms be just as responsible for everything that appears on their platforms?
I think they have to take more responsibility than they currently are, definitely. But I don't know if, you know, they should have a similar responsibility to the legacy masthead publications, because they are not journalistic outlets.
Even though Elon Musk is trying to claim that that's exactly what Twitter is.
Even though too many people get their news from it, they don't, you know, if you're going to go that route, right, then they're going to need editors the same way newsrooms do. Then it's tough. It's a very, very gray area. And I, you know, don't have a good answer to that, I'm afraid.
Sounding off on a website or a site like this is not news. It's a set of opinions, and there's no discretion, and there's no checking of what is said and how it's said. When I'm reading stuff, my system always is saying, is that really true? I need to check it. But I don't think that's the way most people read stuff.
Regrettably not. And to Taiwan, the latest jurisdiction to consider the always highly charged question of whether or not to bundle statues of controversial personages off their plinths. At issue are fully 760 remaining monuments to General Chiang Kai-shek, who founded modern Taiwan after losing the Chinese Civil War to Mao Zedong's communists in 1949 and ruled the island with little truck for dissent until his death in 1975. Chiang's party, the Kuomintang, are still a thing, but now in opposition, and the currently governing Democratic Progressive Party believe that they have seen enough of him. For context, Melissa, thousands of statues of Chiang Kai-shek have already been removed following an investigation into the period of his rule a few years ago. So if they want to get rid of the remaining 760, give or take, is that really that big a deal?
I wouldn't think so, since they've already made the decision to remove them. But obviously, it has become a big deal because the Kuomintang party in Taiwan is now developing closer ties with the mainland.
Ironically, for context, the KMT, despite having fought a war with the People's Republic, are actually the closer of Taiwan's parties to them.
Exactly. Weird. The former leader just was welcomed to Beijing by Xi Jinping. And so, you know, maybe this is another, going back to our first topic, another way that China's trying to influence what's going on in Taiwan.
And in the other direction, Nick, is this also Taiwan trying to make something of a statement to China and to the world that we are no longer quite as tied to you one way or another as you might like to think we are?
Probably. But I think, can I just twist it in another direction,
please,
though, Andrew? Because, you know, it comes back to the kind of arguments there have been in this country about whether, like it happened in Bristol, about whether you keep statues. This is part of the history of Taiwan. Similarly, I remember being in the Russian coup in 1991. And there you had Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the FSB, the KGB. All his statues were being pulled down. Now they're being put back up again by Putin. Now, so it's about the value and also the historical value that a statue does have. Now, there's a difference between one statue and 760 statues and several thousand statues being pulled down. But I think there is an important point here, which most people don't remember, the history of the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek after it happened at the end of the war, but the very distant war. But it is important to have memories of that, even if they are symbols as well. So I wouldn't get too worked up about this. As to the relationships between Taiwan and China, as Melissa said, you had the extraordinary visit to Beijing recently by the leader and seeing Xi Jinping. And that was, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was actually something which was misreported on a website.
On that, just to be devil's advocate on that, I still remember pictures of the goddess of democracy being taken down in Hong Kong. And so that's a statue as well. Then that's all I'll say on that right now.
I remember that in Tiananmen Square in 1989 as well.
Yep.
There in the middle of Tiananmen Square, that enormous statue. It was symbolic of something.
But Melissa, as Nick correctly points out, this has been a global thing in recent years. Obviously, we saw a lot of it in the United States, where various jurisdictions decided that they had been glowered over by representations of Confederate generals for long enough. Have we arrived at any hard and fast rules, do you think, over which statue should stay and which should go? Or is it impossible to imagine any hard and fast rules, which is why there will always be an argument?
I think that's true because, you know, having just come from Washington. Most of the statues that have come down in the States are of slave traders, slave holders. And now, you know, we know that reparations need to be made. And part of that is maybe removing these statues.
And that's happening here in the UK. It's happening in the Caribbean as well.
Except, of course, Nick, and finally on this, you know, it could reasonably be argued, well, not reasonably argued, completely factually stated that Washington and Jefferson, to name but two, were slave owners. Should their statues therefore come down?
Indeed. Same with Colston in Bristol.
Mm. But how do you make the judgment about somebody? Do you decide to judge their entire works by the worst of them or the best of them?
I can't give a view on that, but look at the way colleges and institutions have been torn apart by exactly that question and that debate.
Nick Gowing and Melissa Fung, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, with the rise in cost of buildings, lack of liquidity and high interest rates, the last 12 months have been tumultuous for those in the real estate and property sectors. But as things begin to turn for the better, many are looking for funds and are seeking out their next investment opportunity. Such is the case for global real estate investment manager Hines, which earlier this year left its mark at MIPIM, the world's most important real estate fair. One of those in attendance in Cannes was Alex Knapp, the Chief Investment Officer for Hines Europe. Monocle's Editor-in-Chief Andrew Tuck caught up with Alex by the city's promenade and began by asking him to take the temperature of the market.
The markets definitely this year feel different. We've been through a market correction for real estate on par with the early 90s or the global financial crisis. So it's a 20% correction in values across the board. It's a really material moment, and a cyclical reset, they do happen periodically in real estate, and it feels like we are coming close to the bottom of that cycle. Are we there yet? Are we there in 6 months? I'm not quite sure, but the mood is changing, and that's really driven by the tone on interest rates. The prospect of interest rates coming down for all real estate investors is hugely important.
When you look at lots of the sectors that are important for the people here at MIPIM, whether that's hospitality, retail, resi, data centers, logistics, is that uptick being felt across the board?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't term it as an uptick yet, but certainly a floor in the market is being felt. And what we're observing is in each product type, so for offices, for retail, there are versions of each one that are functioning well. So for office, which has obviously been a big topic in the real estate world and for cities everywhere, in Europe, the CBDs are actually very healthy. Office markets are healthy from the occupational side, and that gives a foundation for values to eventually increase. Indeed, actually, in retail, the same thing is true. It's been a sector that's been untouchable for many real estate investors for many years, and at this point, we're starting to see occupier health stable, fall levels rising again, and e-commerce penetration or adoption rates flattening, which gives everyone more cause for optimism in that sector as well.
Obviously, one of the other big hits to the sector was the pandemic. There were social changes, cultural changes that people felt were going to be, that couldn't be unwound once they happened. One of these was around retail, that we would move to ordering everything online. Another was about the world of work and that we wouldn't return to the office. Again, speaking to people here at MIPIM, not that everyone's going back to the office, but still we're not at the point where we know how many people will finally be back working in the offices, because lots of bigger companies even just now are saying we want people to return to work. And on the retail side, as we discussed before this interview began, there's an interesting shift there as well. Many of the big e-com players have stumbled and shuttered even. How important are those cultural, those social things to you as you begin to try and look at the future of all of these sectors?
Well, I think, you know, our philosophy has always been to be very close to building users. We have a very deep team in Europe. We're more than 900 people. We have 17 offices, so lots of cities, bigger ones, and even some smaller ones. So we're trying to feel the pulse in a really even way across Europe. And I think the observation is right that coming out of a major disruption with COVID and then the e-commerce story as well, it's taken a little time to figure out what the impacts ultimately will be. And we're not, certainly for office, we're not at the end of that yet. But we are seeing certain trends. And in office, I think the big observation I would have is that in Europe, certainly, office use is compressing into city centers, into urban cores, away from the periphery, away from purpose-built office districts, and really into the proverbial live-work-play environments that we've talked about so often. People actually are happy to work there, and building occupiers, office tenants, are willing to pay more rent to be in those locations rather than in more commodity offerings further out.
And finally, as we look to the future, the topic I know that you're thinking about is data centers and building them, what they do to the demands on energy, and maybe nobody's got it figured out yet. Is that another topic that's important to you?
Data centers are definitely going to be a growth area for everyone. Clearly, the emergence of AI in this very sudden and dramatic way has surprised even participants in the tech sector who are very, very close to it. The rapidity and the strength of that adoption, how it's on everybody's tongue at the moment, is really extraordinary. And there will be a real estate implication for that, no question. Data centers is the obvious byproduct of increased computing. Where those data centers go, how much power they use, the ecological considerations for high power demand industries, let's say, in an environment where we're trying to produce energy in green ways is absolutely something we'll be talking about more and more over the coming period.
That was Alex Knapp, the Chief Investment Officer for Heinz Europe, in conversation with Monocle's Editor-in-Chief, Andrew Tuck. That's all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Melissa Fung and Nick Gowing, also to Karina Choi. Today's show was produced by Christy O'Grady and researched by Gunnar Gronlid. Our sound engineers were Tamsin Howard and Flynn Simons. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.